Remember the Maine, remember the Alamo, remember the 5th of November. So these famous sayings were each coined as a sort of rallying cry, calls to take up a mantle with purpose in our hearts, active memorials which brought a person into a different and greater identity and cause. After all his discoveries, all his experiments, all his trial and error, after charting life to the very edges of the map, the teacher comes to the conclusion of it all, and he does not have a secret formula for us. No directions to El Dorado, the city of gold, or the fountain of youth. He has no elixir to share to keep us healthy and wealthy, no list of habits which will make us highly effective people. Instead, the closing words of his lecture is a simple, seemingly overly simple mandate. Remember your Creator. That's it. That's his answer. There are six more verses after our text tonight, but they are actually an epilogue in the book, spoken not by the teacher, but spoken about the teacher. They too will have a clincher and a command to wrap up the book as a whole. But tonight, we hear the teacher's bottom line and watch him as he leaves the stage of the lecture hall, having set before us life and death, fruitfulness and futility, and challenging each of us to live life well. As he ends his long lecture, he invites us to consider the end of our own stories. In his closing, he poetically and vividly describes the ravages of age, which invariably conclude in physical death. Remember, throughout the book, he never talks long without pausing to remind each of us that we are going to die and that we need to do something about that. So we begin in verse 1. So remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of adversity come and the years approach when you will say, I have no delight in them. So in the last passage, if you were here with us, you remember the teacher talked about the joys of youth and how we should fully enjoy the prime of life while keeping a godly and eternal perspective. That it's a good thing and a beneficial thing and even a godly thing to savor the benefits of youth time, the days of life's springtime, as opposed to the winter, which he'll discuss tonight. But those youthful days are going to end for everyone. And in their place will come what he describes as days of adversity. Now, your version may say difficult days, but he doesn't only mean when hard things happen in life. He really is talking about old age. He's talking about that last phase of a person's life. They've survived through all of the difficulties and challenges and decades of life, but now they've come to old age. They're coming to the end. They're in that last phase. That's what he's describing tonight. And three times tonight, in just eight verses, the teacher will use the word before. Before the joy of life ebbs away, before the fall of creation catches up with your physical body, before death comes knocking, we should remember the Lord. And this is the way to the kind of life that we all long for. It seems counterintuitive. But he says, hey, the whole point is that I want to prod you and goad you with sharp sticks of wisdom to help you pursue after a life that's worth living, a life that matters, a life that fills that eternal part of your heart that cries out for more. And he says the way to do that, the way to lay hold of what every soul is looking for is simply to remember the Lord. And we'll get a little bit more into that in a moment here. These days, we hear a lot about self-care. Have you heard that term, self-care? It's a big priority for some people and just kind of a buzz term out in the wider culture. The teacher says that before we devote ourselves or focus all of our attention onto our own well-being, we should first focus on the wellspring of life, the wellspring that doesn't run dry, because he is the source of your well-being ultimately. So while we're over here trying to say, how can I fix things for myself? How can I make sure that I feel a certain way? The teacher says, that's not the way to get where you want to go. Focus on the wellspring of life, because that spring doesn't run dry. And as we read the verses, we see there's an urgency to his advice. Before, do it now. This is the life goal to aim yourself at, to aim your attention and your activities and your desires toward. Now, Jesus had a similar message to the woman at the well. Remember, she comes to the well, Jesus is there, and what does she want? She wants a pitcher of water, of earth's water. And what did Jesus say to her? He says, if you knew the gift of God, and who is saying to you, give me a drink, you would ask him, and he would give you living water. He says, that's what you actually need. Yes, you're thirsty. Yes, you need this physical provision in a jar of water. But right now, the thing you need most of all is living water. And having that conversation and interaction and understanding who the Lord really was, what happens at the end of their talk? A great symbolic moment there where she leaves her water jar behind. She came thirsty, but her deeper thirst was satisfied. And so the physical thirst, she's not even worried about it at the moment because she leaves it behind so she can run back into town and share living water with her fellow Samaritans, the townsfolk. Verse 2, before the sun and the light are darkened and the moon and the stars and the clouds return after the rain. The teacher has never been as painterly as he is in this closing poem. He compares the human aging and dying process in striking graphics: a gathering storm, a crumbling house, a body literally falling apart. Some scholars even detect apocalyptic tones in these scenes, that the cosmos itself is shattering down and coming to an end. In this first analogy, we see gathering storm clouds, a gathering gloom. But this isn't an ordinary storm. It's a storm on top of a storm. We've been going through these foggy days, right? And you go outside, especially last week, it was so foggy, or you can sense it rolling in. And it's as if you went out, you know, one of those really foggy days, and you went out at noon when you expected the fog to dissipate, and instead you just see a quadruple fog then rolling in on top of the fog you just had. That's what he's seen, a storm on top of a storm. This is a final winter which no spring will follow. It signals not only the end of a person's life, but the dissolution of creation itself. Do you know there are a bunch of super rich people, investors, who have dedicated a bunch of money and time to living forever? For real, that's their goal. In 2022, more than 120 millionaires and billionaires met in the Swiss Alps for the Longevity Investors Conference. It's a real thing, somehow. And there, they enjoyed rejuvenation dinners, and they discussed how helpful it is to get transfusions of blood from healthy teenagers. That's not weird at all. They would go and breathe low oxygen air. I don't know what that's about because I wasn't at that conference. But they talk about how we are going to work to transcend biology. And he said, we're going to beat this thing. We're going to beat aging. We're going to beat disease. We're going to beat all of these things. And we are going to extend our lives further, because for these individuals, this life is the only life. And so, of course, like the teacher, they're clinging, clawing, gripping onto it as hard as they can, no matter how futile that is. Now, they're not going to succeed at transcending biology. That's the folly of man, right? But let's say they could. Let's say that they were able to figure out the medicine or the pill or the treatment that could beat every disease or that could roll back aging for centuries upon centuries. Let's say they could do it. Even so, the hevel world has still got them. Because even if you could somehow stave off age and disease and injury, the universe around you is going to end one day. And that's kind of the image seen here. Not only is the personal body and life and experience failing into death, but we see the world around them in verse 2 is starting to fall into decay. The sun and the moon will one day go the way of the dinosaur, we might say. And so for those, you know, people trying to transcend biology, death is still going to claim you. There is no way out. That's the point of this book. There's no way out of death if you're just trying to grip life under the sun. Verse 3, on the day when the guardians of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, the women who grind grain cease because they are few, and the ones who watch through the windows see dimly. So most commentators and scholars see this as a poetic list of the body in old age, different body parts and systems. The hands quiver from feebleness and weakness. The legs no longer have the strength to hold you upright like you used to. The word for women here, your version may say maids or even grinders. It's actually the Hebrew word for the molars, and so they can't chew food like they used to, in part because there's so few. A bunch of the teeth have fallen out. It says, hey, where are all those ladies? Yeah, they're gone. There's a few of them, right? And so that's what we're seeing described. The muscles weaken. The other systems start to fail too. The eyes no longer see the way they did. Those who watch through the window see dimly. Kelly's grandmother, she's in her mid-90s. She was just diagnosed with glaucoma. Some scholars believe they're referring to glaucoma there, right? Now, thanks to the marvel of modern medicine and the time and place in which we live, there's some treatment that could hopefully forestall the progress of that disease, but age is going to claim her vision. There's no way around it, right? And we sort of tell ourselves, yeah, that's part of life. In reality, that's part of death. It's a signal that of what is true of all of us right now, that we are dying because we live in a dying world that is poisoned by sin. Because the Lord came to Adam and Eve and he said, don't bring sin into the world. Because when you bring sin into the world, death comes with it. And it's going to touch every corner of the universe. And Adam and Eve said, I think we know better. I think we'll go our way. And so they welcomed death into the universe with open arms, effectively. And now we get to all die because of it. And now we have a problem in this universe because we have to figure out what we're going to do about the fact that we're going to die. And so the teacher always wants us to go back to that reality, that we have these eternal desires in our hearts and this understanding that humanity really is different. Even the, you know, evolutionary biologists around us who say, well, there is no God, everything's just random chance, it all just happened on accident, or maybe there's a multiverse, there's a universe-generating machine that just churns out billions upon billions of universes, and this is the one that worked out. Yet deep within their hearts, we all understand on a basic level that humanity is different, that we are operating on a different level, and that's because there is eternity crying out in your hearts, because you were made in the image of God. And the temporal world does not satisfy us ultimately. There's something within us, it's your soul and spirit, that cries out for the Lord, that cries out for immortality because it is immortal. And so the temporal is not enough. Verse 4, the doors at the street are shut while the sound of the mill fades. When one rises at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song grow faint. As we age, typically, or stereotypically, we become less and less active, right? And that's kind of the image we're seeing here at the beginning. The regular occupations of life are no longer pursued the way they were before. Production comes to a halt. And yet, many older individuals not only are less active, but isn't it true that they end up sleeping less and less, right? Your grandparents, I don't think my grandma Mary ever slept. When we would go down there and visit, she was awake when you went to sleep, and she was awake when you woke up. She didn't do much, but she was awake, right? And they sleep less and less. They're up before the rooster crows. That's one idea here. And even when they do manage to get some shut-eye, often the slightest disturbance will startle them awake. That's the sketch that the teacher is giving us in these verses. And isn't there a malicious heaviness to that? a cruel irony for the individual. The person in this scene is awake more than the youth, but has less to do and no strength to do it, right? And that's kind of just a perfect image of the fallen world. They must face their frailty for even more hours of the day than they used to because they're just awake longer. They're unable to occupy themselves even with passive enjoyments like listening to music because in this case, their hearing has also deteriorated. I don't hear the people singing. Well, they are singing. You just can't hear it, Grandpa. That's the image here. Verse 5, also they are afraid of heights and dangers on the road. The almond tree blossoms. The grasshopper loses its spring and the caperberry has no effect. For the mere mortal is headed to his eternal home and mourners will walk around in the street. So the effects of the aging and dying process in the world aren't only physical. We see here there is an emotional and mental impact as well. Fear for this individual has a greater place than it does in youth. You know, I don't see too many senior citizens jumping off the roof of their house into the swimming pool. Do you? We've had some neighbors that have done that before. Look out and be like, oh, I don't know if he's going to clear the deck there, but all right, I'll see if we hear the sirens in a couple minutes. But you don't really see senior citizens doing that, right? One, because they're wiser. But two, because there's a healthier fear of the reality of the world, of injury and of death and of affliction and all of that. The almond blossoms here refer to hair gone white. Caperberry refers to the loss of appetites and desires. The grasshopper image is interesting. It can be taken one of two ways, according to scholars. The first one, we've all seen a grasshopper out on a cold winter's day, maybe on that, you know, cinder block wall outside your house, but it's too cold, so it's unable to move, certainly unable to spring or hop, just sort of frozen there halfway between life and death. Or you look at it, or you think of like a praying mantis. You go out there and you look at it, and you're like, ooh, you don't look too good, Mr. Praying Mantis, and their color drains out, and you know that, well, this praying mantis is alive, but is not long for this world, and there's nothing that can be done about it. But it's interesting, the Hebrew can also be rendered as if the grasshopper came and hopped and landed, like on the shoulder of the aging individual, and that grasshopper feels like an immense weight in this image, too heavy to lift. Obviously, it's hyperbole, but he's describing what happens in a human body, in a human life, at the twilight of that life. As the teacher sketches the scene, at this point in a person's life, there's really only one more accomplishment ahead, and that's death, right? We see a funeral procession. That's what we see here. The mourners that are walking around the street, they're carrying the dead person to their grave, and they're going to lay that person in their grave. That's the picture that he's painting for us. And it's interesting, when the teacher talks about the mourners walking around, he uses the same verb that he did all the way back at the beginning of the book when he talked about the turning of the cycles of the natural world, and then again about his own turning from place to place, idea to idea, pursuit to pursuit, in his desperate attempt to find a life worth living. And so we see the poetry of it, that he, this genius individual, the teacher, with all of his resources and all of his time and all of his power and all of his ability, he was able to drink life in and take life by the horns and use whatever, you know, analogy you want, to a further extent than any one of us could ever dream. He did it all. He did it more. He did it to the utmost level in all of these different life pursuits, achievement and pleasure and experience and building things and all of that, making a name for himself, fame and power and pleasure. And yet, no matter what he does under the sun, it's this same turning, like the turning of the seasons that just keep rolling over on each other. Or his desperate turning, trying to find something that would ultimately satisfy, but he came up goose egg every time. And now here it's all brought together, and he says the final turning is just the turning of your pallbearers after they lay you in the grave. He says that's what we're facing in this world under the sun, a turning toward death, a turning toward an end, a turning toward a defeat by the hevel world around us. and how there is no way for us to escape it under the sun. If there had been a way, he would have discovered it. Despite his wealth, despite his power, his genius, his ability, his position, he couldn't outrun death. No one can. This is sort of a comedic or over-the-top or hyperbolic poem, right? Not everybody experiences this kind of frailty, this kind of fear, this kind of, you know, it's obviously meant to be poetic. It's a poem. But the reason why he presents this to us is because this is the end for every one of us on earth. There isn't any way out. There isn't any cheat under the sun by which you can bypass the world as it is. But then the teacher brings to mind there in verse 5 what comes next, that there is something after the mourners put the body in the grave. Did you notice it? Each one of us, our bodies are on our way to the grave, but then each one of us as individuals are on our way to an eternal home. And it's really such a remarkable contrast. Here's the crumbling, dying human body, and yet within it is housed an eternal spirit. And that really has been the major theme of this entire research project the teacher has undertaken. He says, I want to live a life worth living. And he very quickly realized that I can't feel like I've lived a life worth living if my life is only temporal, if my life is only in the here and now, if my life is only defined by this culture, this generation, this place in which I live. He talked about the waste and the futility of that. If this is all there is, what's even the point of living? That's the conclusion he came to in his darker moments. He wants to live a life worth living. He wants to feel lasting fulfillment. He wants to make a meaningful, eternal difference in this world. He wants ultimate satisfaction, but no matter what he did, he couldn't escape time, death, and chance. And so what was he going to do about death? What was he going to do about the fact that he had an appointment with these mourners, with his grave, with this end? You know, the unbeliever spends so much time on his mortal body, but he does so at the expense of his immortal soul, right? And Jesus said the same thing. What profit is there for you to gain the whole world, but you lose your soul? The world is temporal. Your soul is eternal. As I've said a few times in these studies, and I hope you're not offended by it, it's just the truth, you are going to die. You will leave this world, and you will then be ushered into your eternal home. And there are only two addresses in eternity. Lots of addresses in Hanford and Kings County and all around the world. I saw that, where is it? What's the by-the-sea place up in the coast? What is it? Carmel by the Sea. You know, they don't have house addresses. But like the city council is wanting to, they've never had house addresses. It's just like that house over there, right? And the city council wants to now assign them house addresses, and the people are mad because for 100 years they haven't had it. And so there's like this conflict, right? But there's addresses all over the world. In the next life, there are two addresses, heaven and hell. That's it. And so which are you going to be forwarded to? Which is your place of eternal residence? It's a question you must deal with in this life. There's no second chance. There is no purgatory. We like to say around here, we wish there was purgatory. It's a great idea, but it's a human idea that, well, I won't do the thing I should do, and I'm going to rebel against God, but then once I'm, you know, already disqualified, well, I'll get a second chance. I wish there was a second chance. But the Bible presents very clearly, very plainly, that there is not a second chance after death. That it is appointed unto a man or woman once to die, and then comes judgment. Verse 6 says this, before the silver cord is snapped, and the golden bowl is broken, and the jar is shattered at the spring, and the wheel is broken into the well. Remember your Creator is what he said at the beginning. He said, do it before the breaking, before the snapping, before the dying. Some commentators believe the cord and the bowl refer to like a golden lamp, like a bowl with an oil lamp lit in it, suspended by a chain. And when the chain is cut, the bowl falls and smashes on the ground and the light goes out. And then there are two images at a well. One is an earthen jar, which is broken, and therefore all the water is spilled, unable to deliver its life-sustaining power. And then the wheel referenced here would be a pulley installed above a deep well on which the bucket would be lowered and raised. But the wheel breaks and falls down into the cistern, and the well is no longer useful. And in these images, we can recognize, man, do you know how hard it is to make a silver chain? You have to mine the silver. You have to refine the silver. You have to melt down the silver and pour it and mold it and then do all these tiny little links and put them together. It's hard to do. It's hard to make a golden bowl. It's even hard to make a watertight earthen vessel back then, not to mention a capable pulley. But then in a moment, it's all gone. Beyond repair, it's over. That's the image here. And on top of that, we sense the great value of a human life. It's treasure like gold and silver, useful like this pulley and this earthen vessel that is made for a purpose, right? Value and craftsmanship and artisanship. That's not a word. We'll cut that. But what went into making you? And that how precious you are and how designed you are and how purposeful your life was supposed to be, and then it's broken there at the end. Verse 7, and the dust returns to the earth as it once was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Ecclesiastes often refers to the first few chapters of Genesis throughout the book. There's all kinds of references to the first three chapters especially. This is another callback: from dust we came and to dust our bodies will return. But our spirits, where do they go? It returns to God who gave it, the teacher says. They do not go to the earth because they belong to the Lord. He is the one who breathed life into each of us. As Roland Murphy writes, God is the owner and donor of your life. Your life is on loan from the God of heaven and earth. It doesn't actually belong to you. And especially if you're a Christian here tonight, remember, not only did God breathe his life into you, right? And as creator, you belong to him. But then he said, on top of that, I blood bought you. I shed the blood of my only son to pay for you, and you belong to me now. And it should help us put into perspective our surrender to him and our obedience to him and our desire to devote ourselves to him. Your life is on loan from God. When you die, your spirit will be immediately in the presence of God. You will either be judged for your sin or you will be rewarded for your service. Either way, you will live forever. The judged live forever in the lake of fire, commonly known as hell. God doesn't want them to live there. Hell was created for the devil and his angels. You don't need to go there. The people who go there because they are unwilling to receive God's substitutionary atonement in Jesus Christ. The rewarded live forever with God in heaven, in his presence, forever and ever. So obviously this begs the question, how do I get from this group to that group? How do I get into the heaven group? Very simple. Bible says this: believe on the Lord Jesus and you won't perish, right? Most famous Bible verse of all time, John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whosoever would believe in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. In Romans, we are told this very plainly: if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Your eternal spirit transferred from hell to heaven as far as destination. God gave you the life you're living right now. And on top of that, he wants to give you everlasting life with him in heaven. But as sinners, we deserve death. The wages of sin is death. And even though we weren't in the Garden of Eden, we all inherited a sin nature and we all commit individual acts of sin every single day. The wages of sin is death. But the Lord has given us a way out of our guilt, a way out from under the tyranny of life, death, and chance that the teacher sees dominating this world. And that's to accept the indescribable gift of God, the Savior, who took the judgment for sin on your behalf so that you could have the opportunity to live forever in heaven with Him. That's the whole point of Christmas, of course. Jesus is the reason for the season. I'm sure you've seen those signs. He is the gift, right? God's indescribable gift given so that we can be saved from death, saved from hell, saved for eternity, and receive the comprehensive package that is salvation, discussed at length throughout the Bible, but particularly in places like the first half of Ephesians that explained to you salvation is not just about getting out of hell and into heaven, although big thumbs up for that, but salvation comes packed with all kinds of other stuff, all kinds of other benefits, all kinds of other life-changing, world-changing blessings from God. But you must do it now, before the cord is snapped, before the bowl breaks, before it's too late. As I said, it's appointed unto man once to die, and after this comes judgment. Verse 8, absolute futility, says the teacher. Everything is futile. Okay, so hevel. We're back where we started. This is exactly what the teacher said at the very beginning of his lecture in chapter 1, verse 2. Futility, everything is futility. Hevel, everything is hevel. In this life under the sun, in this world, in this reality, everything is hevel. It's a wisp of smoke passing away. Your beauty is fading. Your memory is fading. Your vitality is fading. Your ability is fading. Your opportunities are fading. That is the way things are because of the world that we live in, because sin dominates this world and has ruined God's perfect creation. And so we need a way out from under, right? Out from under the sun. And so the question, though, is the teacher ending here in defeatism and pessimism and frustration? No, not at all. End at the beginning. End at the beginning of the chapter. Look at the first part of verse 1 again, because that's where all of these verses flowed from. It was like the big heading, and then everything flowed from under that. And that beginning is this: so remember your Creator in the days of your youth. That's the answer. That is the bottom line. Remember your Creator. That is the conclusion of how to lay hold to a life worth living. That's how to get lasting satisfaction. Well, how does that work? Well, first, who are we supposed to remember? The teacher did something new here. He uses a new term. He uses the term Creator. Everywhere else in the book, the teacher only called God, God, right? Because he was speaking from a secular perspective, as someone who maybe acknowledged that there is a God up there, but it's sort of impersonal and who really cares? I'm just going to do things on my own. I'm going to live life because I'm the master of my own, you know, future and destiny and all of that. And so he always talked about God as, you know, obviously somebody made all of this stuff, but he's just out there. I don't really have interaction with him, but not anymore. Now he uses for the first time this new term, Creator. And linguists point out that he uses a plural term. It is another connection to the beginning of Genesis, where God said, "Let us make man in our image." And so what the teacher is telling us is not simply to acknowledge a higher power or to just live as like a deist at our base, right? No, he insists that we must find the source of life in the God of Genesis, the God of the Bible, the God who reveals himself, the God who breathed life into you when he created you, an actual person, a very specific God, God the Creator. And the fact that he created you begs the question, what are you created for? God created you for a reason. Can you answer that question? What are you created for? God made you for a reason. He made you for purposes, not as an afterthought, not as a background player or some element to just fill the frame. Your life was given to you on purpose, with purpose. You were created for life. The Hebrew word for life used there in Genesis is hay, H-A-Y. It's hay, not hevel. Fruitfulness, not futility. The Old Testament idea of life, Bible dictionaries will tell us, means to not just have biological vitality, but to experience that which God wants to give us, a sustained life, a truly prosperous life, to be quickened and revived in the power of God. One word for one form of the word describes flowing water. In fact, Jesus used a wordplay on that meaning when he spoke to the woman at the well. He talked about living water. That's life. In fact, Jesus said in John 6 that you may think you're alive, but you're only truly alive if you're in a relationship with the God of the Bible through Jesus Christ. He said, if you're not willing to be in that relationship with him, then you do not have life within yourself. And you say, well, here I am. I'm walking, I'm talking, I'm eating, I'm sleeping. He said, yeah, but you're not actually alive because life is only really life if it's everlasting life. In contrast to Mesopotamian ideas, which taught that man was created to be mortal, the Bible comes along and says, oh, no, you were created for immortality. And the New Testament doubles down when Jesus said he came that we might have life, this life, more abundantly. But the world wants to convince us that the life we're looking for is only found and experienced in tangible things. The stuff offered in the here and now. The measurements of culture that seem to be good, wealth and fame and all that kind of stuff. The world says, hey, no, that's life. That's really living. But it's not true. Look at Solomon. Take him at his word. He says, you will not find life out there under the sun. Not the kind of life that you really need. Instead, the teacher says, if you want to lay hold of life, remember the Lord. And that word remember is just packed full. The theological word book of the Old Testament explains it doesn't only mean to recall or to think about something. It means to meditate upon, to pay attention to commemorate, to take appropriate action. It means to have internal understandings that are accompanied by external acts. It's a thought that does, right? Kind of like faith with works. Remember your Creator. One of the reasons we need to remember him and act on that remembrance is because that's what God does for you. God remembers you. And his memory is not just like, oh yeah, that guy. He acts when he remembers you. What does the Bible tell us? God remembered Rachel. God remembered Noah. God remembered Abraham. God remembered Israel. He remembered Hannah. He remembers us in our humiliation, the Psalms say, because his love endures forever. Remember that the God of the Bible gave you life for a purpose, and he has invited you to receive that life as a gift and to discover those purposes and to live life with him. But be advised, the time is short. And all around you, you've got a world of futility trying to stop you from receiving the gift of life that God has offered you. And so we join with the teacher and say, before you're debilitated or devastated or dead, remember your creator and what you were created for. And remember the difference between the life your creator offers and the so-called life the world under the sun offers. In the life God offers, he gives strength in our weakness and peace in our troubled hearts and rest when we're weary and support when we're broken, a future defined by glory, not gloom. Compare that to the end of the story in this poem. The Lord says, no, I actually want to solve all of those things. I want to give you rest. I want to give you peace. I want to give you strength. I want to give you support. I want to give you provision. I want to give you joy. I don't want your life to ebb away at the end. I want you to be filled more and more and more and more until you're finally in glory with me forever and ever. Free of all the pain, free of all of the sorrow, free of all the guilt, free of all of the heaviness of this world, living only in everlasting life. And so let's remember the Lord, our Creator. Let's pray.